With Halloween just a week away, today's focus dwells on the fun of being frightened. Storyteller Camille Bourne tells ghostly tales of downtown Champaign, full of horror and history, in walking tours this week sponsored by the Orpheum Children's Science Museum. Camille will tell us one of the tales on Focus today. And Illinois native Brandon Massey will talk about what inspires him as a writer of horror fiction. He's written several novels and short stories, and his new book, In the Dark, tells the story of a house that may be haunted due to an unjust foreclosure. I'm Jim Meadows. Let us know what frightens you on this edition of Focus on WYLL. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Fear can be a terrible thing to experience when it's about something that's truly threatening you, yet exciting, cathartic, and even fun when it's a side effect of a good story. With Halloween coming up next Thursday, we'll be talking this hour with horror novelist Brandon Massey. He's an Illinois native who writes stories that come out of everyday life, then take a turn for the supernatural, and not the touch by an angel sort of supernatural either. But first, let's say hello to not a writer of tales, but a teller of tales, a storyteller whose gifts come in not just crafting a story, but presenting it to you with her voice and gestures. No special effects, no explosions, no CGI that I know of. Camille Bourne is also a native of the Chicago area. Nowadays, she lives in Mahomet. And this month, she's been leading guests on walking tours of downtown Champaign, telling tales of hauntings and ghostly appearances that have occurred in downtown Champaign. These tours are presented by the Orpheum Children's Science Museum. The last two tours are this Friday night, I understand.
Yes, that's right, Jim.
And Camille Bourne, welcome to Focus.
Oh, welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
How did this walking tour come about?
Zoe Stinson, the coordinator of the Orpheum Science Museum, came up with the idea. Not that it hasn't been thought of before. Another storyteller and I have thought about doing it before. But Zoe put it on the calendar and said, go to it. And the idea was to find where the hauntings are in downtown Champaign.
How do you research? I mean, these tales are based on fact or at least on legends and lore about downtown Champaign.
Yes, I would have loved for every single one of them to be based on that. But as I began my research, mostly at the Champaign County Historical Archives and going through the old newspapers, I was coming up with the lack of true ghost stories.
It almost feels like a slight on downtown Champaign that they can't muster up some good ghost stories.
You know, Urbana has their famous blue man that's in every historical and every spooky story book. And no, downtown Champaign doesn't have any. I just didn't have enough time to find them, though. We hope to do this next year, and I'll spend this coming year talking to the people who live and work in downtown Champaign, and I'm sure there'll be a few other ghosts there besides the two at the Orpheum.
Nevertheless, you were able to put together some tales.
Oh, definitely. Several areas in downtown Champaign which still look the way they might have looked 100 years ago when the Orpheum was built. And they lend themselves very credibly to possible sightings of ghosts. One is the area is the old railroad yards, which is behind Main Street, behind Joseph Kuhn's store. And you can still there, when you stand there, you can still see where the roundhouse was. You can still get the feeling of dark and eerie warehouses. Unfortunately, these days, there's a light between every single building. But you can still call up the feeling of how it might have been on a night in 1907 when it was reported that a St. Joseph man was killed working at the railroad yards.
Uh-huh. Well, if you know any good ghost stories about where you live, feel free to call in at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WYLL. Our email address, WYLL-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. So I understand you do have one tale from the walking tour that you're ready to tell today on Focus.
Oh, yes. And this one I know is true because I know the house and I know the person. And I was there when the haunting was going on.
And I should say that Camille has brought some photographs, some photographic evidence.
Yes, yes. I can tell you, Jim, that the person who lives in the house that's haunted, his name is Karen. And she had two cats at the time. And that's all I can tell you. She won't let me tell you her address. We'll just say it's in the near west side of Champaign. Karen was remodeling her house, which was built in the early 1900s, one room at a time. And she'd never had any problems with anything being wrong at all until she got to the living room. Now, for every project, Karen took pictures, what the room looked like before, what the work was going on during, and then afterwards. And she would often, when we got together, would share these pictures with us, and we all knew the projects at our house. When they got to the living room, though, one day the crew called up Karen and asked her to come home right away because the cats were going berserk. Now, cats usually run away from the noise, but not this time. When Karen came in, the workman told her it was as if the cats were drawn to this one area of the wall in the living room that they were starting to break through. Yet, even though they were drawn there, it was almost once they were there that they hated to be there and they couldn't stand it. Their backs were arched. Their fur was curled up. They were hissing. They were yowling. And they were pawing at the wall and then running away from it and then being drawn back to it. Weirdest behavior Karen had ever seen out of her cats. And she locked them up. And while she was there, she took the during picture of the construction phase and she watched the workmen for a while. As they broke through that wall, Karen saw something sticking out of it. She pulled it out and there was a rolled up photograph, a nice photograph, something obviously done in a photography studio. But why would that have been put between two plaster walls? The work went on. Karen did some investigating. She found out who had lived in that house, and she found a relative of the lady in the picture. She presented that picture to the man, and he said that was his mother and her high school graduation picture. He had no idea, and there were no family stories about why it would be in the wall. Well, Karen made a copy of it. She figured if that woman had a reason for putting herself in the wall and had been there for so many years, it would be a good idea if she stayed there. The work continued. The new doorway in the wall was finished. Karen took the after pictures. Now, in the pictures I'm showing you, in the before picture, you can see the transparent ghostly figure and the cat staring at it. In the during picture at the same place, the same ghostly, transparent figure. When Karen took the after pictures, there was no ghostly figure. What she did was took a copy of the woman's photograph and hung it on that wall. So the woman in the wall is still there. But the odd thing is, no other picture will stay on that wall.
So this is one of the stories on the tour, huh?
Yes.
Now, will you take the people on the tour to that address, or?
No, as I said, Karen does not want every paranormal expert.
You sort of wave over to the general neighborhood.
Right. I get them as close as I can. Actually, I tell it in the courtyard of the Orpheum, which is a nice dark area that we're in at night. And after that, we go into the Orpheum and I introduce the people to the two ghosts that seem to be an integral part of the Orpheum.
You know, we should let people know, especially if you don't know Champaign-Urbana, the Orpheum Children's Science Museum is a really delightful science museum for kids that is built in the lobby and I think adjacent storefronts of the old Orpheum movie theater in downtown Champaign. That pretty much leaves the movie theater itself untouched. There is an entire pretty big movie theater, huge auditorium, some peeling paints and decorations on the walls, a projection booth I've been able to be led up upstairs into.
Yeah, actually the interior of the theater portion, which they do use for some special events and demonstrations, has been restored. And it's beautiful.
To what degree?
Fully restored to, it doesn't have the seats in it anymore, mm-hmm. but all of the walls and the painting and are restored back to what it looked like in 1914 when it was built. It's the stage that has not been restored, and the dressing room areas beneath the stage, and any of the projection booth and the lighting booths and that have not been updated.
And so are there any stories involved with the Orpheum itself?
Well, there are, and the people that come on the tour get to hear those.
Okay. We're talking with Camille Bourne. She's a storyteller here in Living Muhammad, actually. And you're giving, I guess, two more walking tours in connection with the scary side of downtown Champaign. And if people want to get in on those tours on Friday night, I understand that the earlier tour around, what, 7:30?
7:30 it starts, and that will be family-friendly. I'll tone the stories down. So the 7:30 tour is for children 8 and up, and the other tour at 9 o'clock would be for adults, or we say 12 and up. I would suggest calling for reservations soon. If it fills up, there is a possibility we could put in extra tours next week in the evening. So people should definitely call.
Well, certainly, if you can just try Googling the Orpheum Children's Science Museum. Their phone number is 217-352-5895, 217-352-5895. They're located on North Neal Street in downtown Champaign. Our phone number, if you have maybe some family ghost stories of your own, is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Or maybe you could email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Now, as a storyteller, you tell a lot of different types of stories, but scary stories seem to be a recurring part of the repertoire.
Oh, yes. I enjoy telling scary stories, I guess. I like making middle schoolers squirm. I should put in the evil laugh there. But I do have a long history of doing it. When I was 10 years old, I told my first scary stories. I shared a room with a younger brother who was only 3. And things used to come out of the closet. And the closet handle would turn. Look at it. It's going to come get you. And, of course, he would scream and cry, and my mother would come up and say, "What's wrong with the baby?" And I would say, "I don't know. He just started to cry." And I think ever since then, I've had a love for doing that.
What is the appeal for being scared?
I don't know. And, again, I go back to the junior high years, because that seems to be the time when children really get into, and I know in my own life we really got into scaring each other and telling them all the classic Bloody Mary stories and Resurrection Mary and The Hook and The Haunting with the Babysitter. And in a way, it's a safe scare. It's a fear that's okay to face because you know it's really not true, except for that little part in the back of your mind that says, well, maybe it is, but you're pretty sure it's not. And so it's a healthy fear. And children really do like scary stories. I think they like them more than their parents like to believe.
Now, as you said, on Friday night, you'll be having a more family-friendly version early, more adult version later on. Do kids and adults, you know, are there different things that you tell that will hit them?
Like any stories, be it folktale or historical tales, there are some stories that appeal to all age levels. And so there are some stories that I do tell the same to children and adults, or I change the language a little bit to use words that might be more familiar to the children. But there's a very famous story often told around campfires about black bubble gum.
Black bubble gum.
Black bubble gum that a girl receives as a trick-or-treat candy. But she receives it from an old woman who says, "I love little children." And the black bubble gum goes on to finding its way immediately into the girl's mouth and then begins to chew itself. Now, the whole story I could tell the same way to adults and children, and everybody likes that one as is. One's about, let's say, the brakeman, the railroad brakeman who bobs along with his lantern on the railroad line looking for his head. Kids seem to like that one actually a little better than adults, who get a little squeamish at the fact that the brakeman actually lost his head someplace along the railroad when he was decapitated.
Really?
Yes.
Kids are more accepting of that sort of thing.
Yeah, it is, because I think they know it's fake. Uh-huh. Or they don't realize it. What it would be like if it really happened in real life.
So maybe they it's a little more difficult for them to imagine the trauma, which...
Right, or putting it to someone they know or a real-life person.
Okay.
They don't yet have the empathy to do that.
But so it can still be scary in an entertaining manner for them.
Right, and it doesn't have to be gory. I don't tell gory, scary stories or horrific ones because that's not... what it's about. Mm-hmm. Telling spooky stories is about creating that that suspense and getting the little hairs on the back of your neck to stand up.
With adults, are there things you can draw on, like, you know, ideas, say stories concerning a love affair or certain family ties that kids just wouldn't get emotionally the same way?
Yes, and that is one way I do choose which ones to tell to adults. If there's there can be actually some heartwarming spooky stories about death, or the legend of the chrysanthemum from Italy, which is about when death actually stayed her hand for a family. And those are not comforting at all to children, but they are to adults, to speak frankly outright about death, or to talk about deaths that happened in a violent way or in an illegal way, like the story from downtown Champaign about the police officer who was killed when he went after a bootlegger. I tend not to mention bootleggers and illicit activities along South Market Street to children.
a little too complicated. Well, besides that children versus adults dichotomy, are there perhaps other rules or guidelines for telling a good, scary story? Are there certain things they need to have?
Every story has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And in the middle someplace, it has to have a conflict, and the conflict needs to be resolved.
No avant-garde fiction here.
No. Actually, it's one of the problems with true spooky stories is that continuing hauntings don't have an end.
They're unresolved.
That's right. So
it's better for a ghost story for it to be a complete haunting, which has been resolved somehow.
Yes. That's more satisfying to the teller, certainly more satisfying to the listener, especially if the story ends well, with the ghost departing and the and the people being being left. The historical stories that adults really enjoy are the ones on the tour that I do talk about. Do have their origin on Market Street, which was basically a den of iniquity in Champaign County.
Now, the thing about Market Street, I walk up and down, you know, Market Street in the downtown area. There hasn't been much done to Market Street over the years.
No, that's true. Market Street, and also at Market and Main Street, from Main Street down to the Illinois, to the old passenger station in downtown Champaign, are pretty much original to the late 1800s.
And it's just amazing, considering all the development that does exist in downtown Champaign, that Market Street is still relatively, I have to keep on saying, intact.
Yes, there's a set of three buildings there built in the 1870s called the Cast Iron Building, and they lend themselves to storytelling. They were on the bottom floor, a legal billiard room, but
upstairs,
and side entrances were members-only club for athletic clubs or social clubs. And I learned these things when I was researching for the Prohibition stories that I do. The member card got you privileges. upstairs might have been bare knuckle fighting, and there were certainly illegal beverages. And this is long before Prohibition in the U.S. Prohibition in Champaign County started in 1908.
Okay. So there was the hop in place downtown Champaign.
Yes. And interestingly enough, both the newspapers at the time would just say that things happened at a well-known lake location on Market Street.
It sounds like they were protecting themselves as well. Well, and that also, the stories that you tell, certainly the scary stories, are they, is it, do a lot of them come out of come out of these sort of historical events?
A few of them do come out of the historical events, or I try to set the scary story, which might be a generic story. I try to set it in a place that people recognize, because then it brings it home. It's much closer and everybody can make a connection with it, mm-hmm. as if it really happened there. Many of the buildings in downtown Champaign, the second and third stories of them were hotels. So next to the Coons store on the second and third floor was the Central Hotel.
Okay.
Well, it turns out they say maybe there was a haunted room in that. To put it in a setting that the audience can connect with makes a story more gripping and more lasting to the audience if you feel like you were there, whether it's a historical story or a spooky one.
Okay. I wanted to ask you just about your own your own progress as a storyteller. You did not become a professional storyteller until relatively recently. You spent a lot of your adult life doing other things for a living.
Yes, I was a I did all sorts of organizational things. I was a business manager. I was an administrative aide, that type of thing, or a professional volunteer for years. But in 1995, at the request of the Girl Scouts, I started portraying Julia Gordon Lowe, the founder of Girl Scouting in the U.S., in historical costume in a 1921 uniform and telling stories as if I were her, stories out of her life.
What was that like for you to do that after not having really done things like that?
You know, I had always done public speaking. I've never been afraid of getting up on a stage, and I had always told stories of what was happening in my life to my friends and other interested people. So telling the story part wasn't or being able to tell a story wasn't a problem for me. Learning to construct the story's beginning, middle, and end, and not just tell a series of anecdotes was something that I had to learn. But to portray Julia Gordon Lowe was a pleasure for me, because she, if she were alive, she would be my mentor. Otherwise, she's a great role model. She didn't start the Girl Scouts until she was 50 years old.
Uh-huh.
And she had not done anything like that in her life. So when I was 50 and said, what is it I want to do now that the kids are out of the house, storytelling came to mind. And it seemed perfect. If she could invent Girl Scouts from 50 years old, certainly I could start something else too.
And this is something that keeps you. You've certainly done a lot of work in schools around here and also in the Chicago area where you're from.
Yes, and actually I don't do as many schools because I tend to specialize in historical stories. I get bookings at museums and uh-huh. libraries, senior citizens groups, any place where people are interested in history, because I do have a wide selection of historical stories to tell. The most recently one that I created this year was called Flashback Nam, about Vietnam, and I did that for the Barclay Library in Warrensburg, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And that's an hour-long historical story focusing on that era plus today, looking back. I do one on the Prohibition scrapbook. I do one on the Dust Bowl testimony. The Museum of the Grand Prairie had asked me to create a Prairie Woman character for a program of theirs about 6 years ago. And that character, who comes to Champaign County in the 1830s, has grown. She has a whole life. She has a family. She has a son. Two sons who fight in the Civil War. And I tell her story and create her life all through 1865 so far. But I know she lives to 1890, so I'm going to start doing research on her life after 1865.
Well, that'll be something itself, I think, to look forward to. So that's a recurring performance that you give at the museum?
I do get it at the museum. I do it at Shoals Pioneer School up in St. Charles. Or anywhere. I dress in character. I can just come and sit in front of the fire and talk to you just what it was like around here in the 1840s and 50s, because if we don't keep mentioning it, why, people are going to forget.
Okay. You know, we just had an email that come in, someone asking, Just thinking about you scaring the daylights out of your three-year-old brother with those scary stories. And they were wondering, can, you know, scary stories can be entertaining. Can they go beyond that? Can, if you're not careful, and maybe the fact that you have two different versions of your walk on Friday night, can they go too far with kids?
I'm not a psychologist. my brother seems to have turned out all right, although his daughter does tell me he's still afraid of closets. I think a child with an overactive imagination could hear too much. Mm-hmm. But I also think part of how they react to the stories also depends on how the parents react. And if the parents are very cautious with the children and don't talk about it as natural, and it just kind of brush it off and say, oh, you shouldn't have heard that. That's just a story. Don't listen to that. Then the child might ponder on it too long. And so if children come up to me afterwards and say that something was too scary, I let them know if it was true or not, or I let them know how much I invented mm-hmm. so that they don't go away with uneasy feelings.
Okay. So you don't mind showing all the tricks of the trade to somebody in that case?
No, I would like them to sleep that night.
Yeah. Well, you can try testing your ability to handle being frightened, I guess, on Friday night if you want to sign up with the Orpheum Children's Science Museum for one of the haunted tours of downtown Champaign, the 7:31 a little milder, and then the 9 o'clock one a little not so mild.
Right.
So contact the Orpheum Children's Science Museum for more information on that. I understand you'll also be at the Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, I guess, the following weekend.
Yes, I'll be a part of the afternoon oleo of the storytellers from the Champaign-Urbana Storytelling Guild.
Okay.
We do that every year.
Well, that should be fun as well. And you can find out more about Camille Bourne on her Facebook page. Just look for Camille Bourne Storyteller. And Camille, I wanted to thank you very much for coming on the program today.
Oh, thank you, Jim. It's been my pleasure.
It is time for a short break, and we will be back in a moment with another expert on scaring people on Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and like our previous guest, Camille Bourne, Brandon Massey grew up in the Chicago suburbs, and he says Chicago settings can often be found in his fiction. His first horror novel, Thunderland, was awarded the Gold Pen Award by the Black Writers Alliance. In all, Brandon has published, if I'm counting correctly, 8 novels and one short story collection. He's also the editor of the Dark Dreams horror anthology series. His 9th novel, again, if I'm counting correctly, is In the Dark. It's set for publication next month. And Brandon Massey joins us on the phone from the Atlanta, Georgia area. Brandon, welcome to Focus.
Glad to be here.
Well, I'm just wondering, was there a book or a movie that, like, really, really, really scared you when you were a kid?
Oh, there were plenty of movies and books that frightened me when I was a child, to be sure. One of my earliest memories, and my mother would probably kill me if she knew I were talking about this. Do you remember the movie Alien?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so when I was 5 years old when that movie came out.
You saw Alien when you were 5?
I was 5 years old.
In the theater or on TV?
In the theater.
Oh, my gosh.
So you can imagine, you know, the classic scene of the alien exploding out of the man's stomach.
That's not traumatic at all, is it?
You can imagine the impact that that had on me. That's one. That honestly is the first experience that I had with, you know, fictional horror, and it made a very powerful impression on me.
Well, you know, we had a question earlier when I was talking with Camille Bourne about whether a really spooky story can be a little too much for a kid. Can there be cases of traumatizing a kid, or is it something that a kid can process and be entertained by? Were you entertained by Alien at that young age?
I think I was quite entertained. I was probably had some sleepless nights after that. I would say, you know, personally, I don't think I would let my daughter, I have a 3-year-old, I don't think I would let her see something like that. Just because, you know, kids do have very active imaginations, and it can be a little hard for them to distinguish between what's fantasy and what's real.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you know, seeing that particular movie made a strong impression on me, and I I went on to read, authors such as Stephen King, Dean Koontz, and many others who really nurtured in me that love of horror fiction.
And is that something that, you know, is there a certain moment or a certain feeling that you try to get at in your own work?
I really like to get at what they call the, it's a climactic moment where it seems like all is lost for the character. They've battled, you know, the adversary throughout the story, and things have reached a point where it just seems like no matter what they do, they're going to fail, they're going to die, their loved ones are going to die. And I love to portray, to write the stories all the way up into that moment, because I think as a reader, I know for me personally, it takes me literally to the brink of death, where you almost see death. And then, at the last second, to have a turn of events where the character finds a way to survive, a way to protect their loved ones, is literally like just turning away from that white light at the end of the tunnel, if you will.
And there's something cathartic about it then.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's just an experience as a writer and as a reader and a viewer of, just sort of coming to that brink of death and then being saved, finding a way out. I think it helps us to experience those emotions of fear, you know, of horror, in a safe way that's completely different than what we would experience in real life. So it's a way for us to just live vicariously, I think.
We're talking to horror fiction writer Brandon Massey. What horror novel or movie has scared you effectively? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. And the toll-free number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Brandon, I understand you have an excerpt from one of your works that you can read to us.
I do. This is an excerpt from my upcoming novel entitled In the Dark. It will be published on November 19th. And I'm just going to read an excerpt from the first scene. I'll go ahead now.
Okay.
When Reggie King stepped inside the rental house on that rainy Saturday evening, the first thing he did was draw his Glock 9mm and begin searching from one room to the next, opening doors and flipping on lights as he moved. He had to make sure the place was empty. As he searched each room, he kept one hand wrapped around the gold crucifix that dangled from his necklace. His other hand was steady with the gun, a good sign. He had been so terrified the past 3 days that his sure grip gave him confidence that he was regaining control of his life. The only sounds in the house were the rain drizzling on the roof and his labored breathing. He didn't hear the noises that he feared the most, the whispers and the soft laughter that had been following him like his own shadow. The house was clear. It was a safe place for him to spend the night, and, he hoped, at least the next few days, until he could figure out what was going on. He returned to the front room. He dropped his suitcase in the entry hall and left his bag of Chick-fil-A sitting on an end table. He grabbed the paper sack and headed into the kitchen. After 24 hours without eating, he was ravenous. He sat at the table, gun at his side, and ate two of the chicken sandwiches before he even bothered to check his new cell phone. It was a prepaid phone that he'd picked up and activated earlier that day. He'd discarded his BlackBerry yesterday, had literally taken a hammer to it and smashed it until the electronic guts leaked out. No one had his new phone number. He needed to call a few folks in his inner circle and let them know how to reach him. He thumbed on the power button. Two text messages were already waiting for him. The first one was a welcome message from the wireless provider, explaining the rates for sending and receiving texts. The second text came from a familiar but impossible source, the number of his own BlackBerry that he'd pounded to bits yesterday. And the message read, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay."
Okay, and that's from your new novel, In the Dark, coming out next
November
month.
November 19th, yes.
November 19th, and I've seen a little bit more of the excerpt. It only gets a little gorier from there, I think.
Yeah, it gets a bit more horrifying.
But you start from, I understand, the premise for the novel starts with something Really, what's been a rather almost everyday occurrence in the last few years with this economy, and that's a home foreclosure.
Exactly. The main characters are a family with a young child, and they've always wanted to live in a classic Victorian home in a historic neighborhood in Atlanta. So what ends up happening is they find a house on the market that was a foreclosure, and it's being, you know, sold at a very reasonable price. So they're able to secure the property, move in, and the weekend that they're moving in, that Sunday morning, they get a knock at the front door. The husband opens the door and sees this very tall, elderly man standing on the threshold, and this man tells him, "This is my house. I lost it in the foreclosure because I was scammed by a con artist. I want my house back, and I'm giving you 3 days to move out." So that's the premise of In the Dark, is what happens within that three-day period. But as I do with a lot of my stories, I like to begin with what I feel is a very credible, realistic, launch point. So as you were saying, you know, it's the housing market bubble that we've gone through, and all the different subprime loans and all that type of stuff that really ended up with a lot of people losing their houses or getting into mortgages that they really weren't prepared to pay for.
You know, I'm thinking as I listen to your describing the premise of the novel and also to that little scene that you read, they both involved a threat. And there's just something very effective, I guess, about a well-delivered threat that can hang over your head, I guess, for the rest of the story, or hang over the character's head.
Absolutely. And I think part of delivering that sense of dread that a really good story gives you, impending dread, building dread, is really it begins with the initial premise. I find that using something that people are familiar with is a good way to start. And then painting a background, a setting that also seems real. So, you know, we'll talk about, a Victorian home. You know, what does this house look like? Go into the details of, you know, how old is this house? What are some of the features of this house and so forth? And then from there, it's really and primarily digging into the characters themselves who are confronted with this conflict. Who are these people? What is their background? What do they want? What are their primary motivations? What are their subplots? You know, what are the other issues outside of the primary story that they may be dealing with? You know, are they dealing with work issues? You know, was there a prior infidelity that's sort of been a plague on the marriage? And all those different aspects of writing a story combined to create a very effective experience because you're just completely sucked into the world that the writer has created.
Does it, which is harder, and I guess when I'm asking that question, I'm assuming that they're two separate things for you, that is getting the initial idea and then developing it into a finished work with an effective structure.
I think the hardest part for me is executing the story. You know, it's pretty easy to get a good idea. You know, I can sit down and have five good ideas in an hour, but the real work is saying, okay, well, I have this initial premise. How am I going to develop this into a fully blown story? Who are the characters that will populate the story? What type of people will best dramatize the conflicts of the story? Where does this story need to take place? You know, all those different decisions. And along with thousands more, and along with just simply sitting down and writing one sentence after another, is an incredibly challenging process. You know, it's something that I've loved and I've loved to do since I was a teenager, but it's certainly not something that's ever been easy.
You know, when I hear stories about how people came writers, there seem to be at least two threads I've heard. One of which is someone's looking around for something to do and or something to make money from, and maybe they pick up a magazine and read a story and say, well, I can do at least this good.
Right. Right.
And, you know, they sell their first story in, you know, their Edgar Rice Burroughs or Robert Heinlein, and that's how they go. And then there are people who just have wanted to be writers since they were very young, and they just plug away at it forever until they're able to put together something they can sell. Which one is you?
I'm in the latter camp.
Okay.
Did
you want to be a writer when you were pretty young?
I did, yes. It was something that I'd always loved to read, always loved writing. I actually enjoyed English classes in school. So, you know, and I got some encouragement early on from my teachers and from my mother as well. So it was a natural thing for me to get serious about, you know, as a young person. And, you know, as time went on, I was eventually able to get published. I sold my first piece of fiction when I was 23 for a speculative fiction magazine. Actually, that was based out of Evanston, Illinois. So that was my first publication, and then I published my first novel, Thunderland. Originally, I had self-published it, and then the book did fairly well, you know, independently, so I ended up signing a deal with a publisher out in New York called Kensington. But it's been something that it's been a lifelong dream for me, so it's just really exciting and gratifying to be able to write these stories and have people who look forward to reading them and give me feedback on the stories. It's just really a great thrill.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time to get your questions in for horror fiction writer Brandon Massey. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The process of writing, the act of writing, do you enjoy writing itself?
I do. It's something that I do every morning. I get up early, 5 o'clock every morning, write for a couple of hours. And trust me, there's no way that I could do that if I didn't enjoy it. It'd be much more, it's very tempting sometimes to just stay in bed. But, it's something that I've just always loved, even though there are aspects that can be frustrating. You know, when you're trying to get a scene to read just right and you're not quite sure what words to use, that can be a challenge. But the act of writing is just something that I've always enjoyed. Now, the world of publishing, that's a different beast altogether. You know, that's probably a different conversation.
And I'm wondering with that, are you still self-publishing?
I do still self-publish, yes. I published 12 books with Kensington, but throughout that period, I still continued to self-publish work as well.
So the new book next month is coming out from which avenue?
That the new book, In the Dark, I'm going to publish independently, so that would be self-published.
I gather there's been, you know, some changes in the publishing industry that self-publishing is you can get farther with it now than maybe you could a few decades ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's with advances in technology for print-on-demand books and especially, you know, e-books, e-readers, you know, the Kindle and Nook, all these other devices. It's really expanded the market for self-published authors, and you can really reach pretty much the same audience for the most part that you could have with the traditional publisher.
Okay. Getting back to horror fiction, because I'm wondering, you do try to start with a pretty everyday premise, but how do you go about scaring people? Have you ever figured out why this works? How do you scare people about something that they just know is impossible?
Well, I think part of the way to do that is really through the details that you deliver in the story. I like to really focus on what I feel are the vivid, well-chosen, authentic detail that really paints a scene, that really brings it to life. So that's the first part of it, is creating a believable world through the use of the proper details. Also, creating characters that are three-dimensional. You know, people who they have good sides, they have bad sides. You know, you don't want to just write about people who never do anything bad or don't have any bad habits. You need to create believable, fully fleshed out characters. And then once you've gotten that part, one thing I like to to focus on as well is when you're writing about the supernatural, you still have to have some internal logic. There have to be rules. And you see this all the time with some of the classic vampire novels. There'll be such things such as, you know it's a vampire because you don't see his reflection in the mirror.
Yeah, all those rules that we know we're sure about as far as vampires, yes.
Right. Or werewolves where, watch out. If you hear a howl and there's a full moon and there's a werewolf afoot and you know that a silver bullet is going to bring him down. So all these different rules writers create in the process of, delivering these, really unreal stories. But I think just the human mind, it really demands order. So even in the midst of writing about something that is probably illogical and would never happen, we still have to make it sound like it could happen by establishing certain ground rules for what's possible in this particular world of the story.
And that's something that, that strikes me as far as being able to get those grounding of details, starting with, with real life details. You're an African-American writer. Are there any particular cultural cues or traditions that you bring to your fiction from that background that perhaps other writers would not get?
I do draw on some of the things that I've just experienced personally. A common thing in black families is to have a family reunion, for example. So every summer or every 5 years or so, we'll have a big gathering, normally in the South, normally in August, late August, early September. And we'll just get together and reminisce and meet up with people that we haven't seen since the last family reunion. To me, that's something that, some of my non-African-American friends, they're not really familiar with that. But it's something that's very prevalent, in our culture.
Is that a setting you've used in your fiction?
I have. I've used it in some of my stories, or I've used it just as a way of building some of the characters. They may have a pullback to a memory of a particular family reunion one year. Just small things like that. Some of the food that may be consumed, like for in the Dark, the new book, one of the characters is from Haiti, so she prepares Haitian cuisine. So that's just one way of just really utilizing the cultural background of the characters, even though in the midst of the story, they're really exploring universal themes. The things that all people experience, love, hate, fear, sadness, hope. Ultimately, everybody goes through those things and experiences those emotions. So, there's when reading my books, you can read them really without feeling like there's anything being exclusionary, if you will. They're just really just good stories with believable characters.
One thing I gathered, and really just reading a few bits of your fiction, and maybe this is something about horror fiction itself, is working with family ties and how you can find frightening things going on that are perhaps exacerbated or amplified by those family bonds that just wouldn't happen the same way if they were just a bunch of strangers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime there's a murder, the cops are always looking to see who's the closest person, who's the husband. Anytime a woman's killed, who's her husband? Who's her boyfriend? It's because those family bonds are just, they run so deep. They say blood is thicker than water, and that's so often true. Because your family, they know things about you that no one else does. They're able to, like if I talk to one of my sisters, she's able to talk about something that I may have done when I was 9 years old. Well, my current set of friends, they may not know anything about that. And your family, they know how to push your buttons. they can just bring up something that you did 20 years ago, and you're like, oh, man, what are you talking about that still for? So I've just found that it's a very effective way to dramatize a story is to really pull in the family dynamic and use that as the basis of the rest of the tale.
Are you able to write full-time at this point, or do you still have a day job out there somewhere?
I do have a day job, and I've been very fortunate because it's a job that allows me a lot of flexibility. You know, I'm able to work from home pretty much all the time. So, you know, it's very easy for me to, you know, do that getting up in the morning. And then my commute, well, I don't have a commute. I just switch laptops. Okay, here I am. I'm at work now.
Well, are you working, now you have this new book, In the Dark, coming out next month. Are you working on something new at this point already?
I'm actually finishing the final edits on In the Dark. Literally will be done next week. And as soon as I'm done with that, I'm going to go right into the next book, which I'm hoping to have finished by around the same time next year.
There's an idea rattling around in your head right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, sometimes it's not a good idea to tell this early, but I wish you the best of luck on this new book and whatever's coming out ahead.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You'll be able to find out more about both our guests. If we don't have it linked now, we'll have it linked very soon at our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Brandon Massey, I believe your own personal website is brandonmassey.com.
That is correct.
Well, thank you for joining us on Focus today. And again, Brandon's newest book, In the Dark, is due out next month.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show, produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Sari Lesk, our intern, helping with production and research. Pet care advice tomorrow on Focus with Sally Foote. Also, the economics of being an adoptive dog owner with Jane Dallas. This is Focus on WYLL.